And it is the co-chair, but it's John Gibbons hosting this week. And we're going to look at all the Premier League action from the weekend. And best place to start feels like with the biggest winners, Leicester City won 5-1 at the weekend. Might have only been Watford, Peter. I know Watford are sort of struggling. Obviously, they're going down and look a bit despondent. But they still need a beating. They got a 0-0 against Everton in the week. But you guys had no such problems scoring against them. In fact, five times away from home can't be bad.
Yeah, not bad at all. You play two relegated sides and you expect to win both games. Norwich game, obviously, before that. And you put a combined 8 goals past with only conceding 1 from, guess what, a corner. So it was, end of the day, you beat the team that you expected to beat. But in a style which I think is very pleasing for Leicester fans, Vardy back scoring goals. He's now record in the Premier League. It's fantastic. Incredible. And then you look at the way the goals went in, and I know they're playing against a team who are very open and were looking to kind of get forward and put on maybe a bit of a show and make it a bit of an end-to-end game. And ultimately, they got pulled apart by some good passing midfield, like some Yuri Tillemans, etc., and especially James Maddison. But then when you've got a player up front with the movement of Vardy, and even though in his advancing years, his speed eventually will and his sharpness will eventually kind of slow down. But movement-wise, his intelligence of movement, I still think, in terms of the Premier League, there's probably not a more intelligent mover of a centre-forward. Finding space, creating space, and then attacking that space. That's how he scored his goals in the last 3-4 years, rather than just the electric pace over the top that we saw in especially 2016.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point, how he's adapted as a footballer, and how, you know, that needs to happen, you know, as age and I guess injuries sort of catch up as well. He's on 14 now for the season, which is a bad considering he's missed chunks of the season with those injuries. I saw a stat as well, said he scored 26 goals against promoted teams since the start of 2014-15, which shows he's a bit of a bully, if you like, which is what you need. You know, these teams need put into the sword, and no one better than Vardy, it seems.
He's just an amazing footballer overall, and he does pose a really difficult question for Leicester, because eventually it's going to be who's going to wear the number 9 shirt away from Jamie Vardy. Well, if he stays fit, the person who wears the number 9 shirt is Jamie Vardy, because he's still scoring goals. He's still a very, very effective Premier League striker. And the problem Leicester have got, of course, is what happens when he doesn't play. Who comes in, and also what style they play. I think it's very common now knowledge in the Premier League that the way Leicester play with those three forwards, when Vardy's not playing, the team is diminished no end. They changed that at the end of last season, towards the end of last season, through injuries, and the way that Claire Chiannaccio then scored all them goals towards the end of the season, thought, well, we're going to play 2 up front now, and that's the way that Vardy can play alongside someone. Rodgers have reverted back this season. I know this season's been a complete mess regarding injuries, etc., and it really has been, and it's a sort of line, and I've said it a million times, you hate really trotting out, but my word, when you look back, it's just incredible. When you see Evans and Fofana playing at the back, and you realise only a few weeks ago, it's the first time they played together since the FA Cup final. Wow. You do realise how much they have missed all of the season. So there are big question marks going forward. A huge summer ahead of Leicester, absolutely massive. It's not like it's a hidden secret. It's been signposted by the manager no end of times. There's going to be massive upheaval in the summer. Very exciting, really.
Danny Ward gets a game, our old friend. Not much seen. There was a bit of a surprise before the game. Kasper Schmeichel, 149 consecutive appearances, which is quite a record. And I'm sure one he would have preferred to carry on. But he gives Danny Ward the nod. Do you understand why the manager did that?
Yes. Today, they've kind of explained it. At the time, there was a bit of is it going to be the season where Schmeichel ends up leaving for another club for a few years? I've always said I can see Kasper Schmeichel playing for another big, maybe European side for the final, say, couple of years of his career. And it was a bit of a surprise. And then today it's kind of been explained, look, Danny Ward, if he's going to be the next player to take over the number one jersey, then he's going to need time. And it was kind of pre-agreed. He had a good game. Schmeichel, 149 games. I mean, he would have loved that 150 games on the bounce in the Premier League, 4 and a bit years or so. It's a conversation that ultimately will happen at some point. The one curveball in this is we have a lone goalkeeper away at at Preston, Everson, who is the number two for Schmeichel in his country, generally considered that he's the best goalkeeper in the championship. An amazing season for Preston, player of the year. And I mean, obviously, following Leicester, you don't really see what's happening at Preston, but you could not have better reviews from fans, the club, etc. So I think when it comes to the point of when we're replacing Kasper Schmeichel, it's going to be a fight between the Wales' number one goalkeeper, Danny Ward, eminently a very decent goalkeeper, perfectly stable. And you'd say probably actually looking in the reserve goalkeeper list in the Premier League, one of the best reserve goalkeepers around, you know, an international goalkeeper, very steady. And yeah, he was fine, absolutely fine. And you just wonder with this game, Schmeichel was going to come in against Chelsea. What happens then in the summer? I wonder if it will just jog one or two clubs to say it might not be worth a cheeky bid for Kasper Schmeichel, who is obviously still fit, still one of the best goalkeepers around, really. He's, after a couple of rocky performances earlier on this season, maybe the first 6 or 7 weeks of the season, a little bit dicey, Schmeichel. Since then, he's had quietly had an excellent season, by the way, a really excellent season. So he's not gone down in anyone's estimation at Leicester. But I just wonder whether a few clubs might be looking at him going, oh, I wonder whether there's a chance he could move.
Yeah, you know, it sort of, you know, crossed my mind when it sort of happened. But I think, as you said, they've explained it pretty well and just sort of try to be fair and keep people sharp. And, you know, in terms of the rest of the season for you guys, there's two games here. There's an opportunity maybe to finish eighth, which wouldn't be too bad. I mean, Leicester, you know, have obviously about much better seasons than this one. But with everything that's gone on with the issues, you know, it feels to me, I don't know if you agree, that, you know, if an eighth place finish, if it was possible, you know, wouldn't be too bad at all.
Not at all. I've still called it the lost season, just because of what's happened. It's been unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable. I've seen nothing like this at any time in my watching career of Leicester. Really looking elsewhere, there's been one or two clubs, etc., with big players. Obviously, your boys with Van Dijk, you know, what a player to miss out for that season. But the amount of, and it's just been incredible. The Fofana, obviously, injury was the one, but the rest of the team absolutely destroyed. So when you turn around and say you finish eighth and you reach a European semi-final and you have all those trips abroad and that, you go, well, actually, overall, not bad. The naysayers, the people who will argue about it, will say, well, we were 14th a few games ago. And they were saying, well, we can't be 14th. Yeah, but two games later, you're ninth and you may be finishing eighth. So you can't really use your argument to promote your point. And then when someone else uses the same argument saying, well, we're eighth, you go, well, yeah, but it's not good enough because we're only 4 points off 14th. Doesn't matter. It doesn't work that way. You know, you've got to stick to your argument. If we finish eighth and finish in and have a European semi-final and all those trips abroad, then great. That's fine. There's been some really, really disappointing moments this season. Poor performances. There's been some players who have really disappointed. There's been some errors by the manager, some horror shows. But overall, I think if Leicester finish eighth or ninth, top half of the league, you can look and go, with all that's gone wrong, it shows actually that the base level of the club is about ninth or eighth. And then if you do have a half competent season, they are generally, say, a top six club. Big six is completely the wrong word, but they're in the top six kind of a picture. So we will see. And the summer is going to be very interesting. Wholesale changes, first team players leaving, and I think some of those have been signposted already. And looking at the bench and the players who aren't on the bench, I think you can see that. So there's going to be changes to the first team squad because there's no European football for the first time in a long time. There's going to be a smaller first team squad. I can see around about, and this is common knowledge, lots of local reporters with better access than me, 6 or 7 first team squad players leaving, and also around 4 genuine first team 11 players coming in. Lots of changes in midfield, and I think also, obviously, at centre half as well, in the defence, there'll be 1 or 2. But the midfield, especially after the game against Watford, Rodgers has not been backward in coming forward with saying about some of the changes. He earmarked the midfield. Tielemans will go. I think other players will leave, maybe even Ndidi, someone like Soyuncu, players who have disappointed, Vestergaard, etc. They will go. Fringe players, your Perezes, your Chowdhury's, all will go. Who will come in? We will see.
We will see indeed. Exciting summer ahead. I'm going to have my eye on it now. You've got me in church. Yeah, never mind Leicester City supporters.
It's going to be interesting. I've got one or two ideas. I would like a little bit more experience personally. Ward-Prowse, love to see him in a Leicester shirt because we're terrible from free kicks, terrible from corners, dead ball situations. Love to see Lingard, a permanent deal for someone like Lingard. Remember when he was at West Ham for those 4 months,
yeah,
you could argue he was one of the best players in the Premier League for that 4 months. He was just unbelievable. Someone like him, maybe even a Wan-Mata, someone with a little bit of experience for a year. That sort of player, I think, could really link together this Leicester side. But we'll see. We'll see.
We'll see indeed. Huge thanks to Pete for joining us as ever this morning. And I think we're going to go to Tottenham now.
So I am now joined by Flav from the Fighting Cock for the Coach Home to talk a little bit more about Tottenham. And the chase, Flav, for the Champions League football continues.
Yeah. I mean, somehow it seems like this journey's, you know, it's been bobbling around. We didn't really know who was going to get over the line. 1 minute Spurs were, you know, in the driving seat, then we slip up, then Arsenal in the driving seat, and then we're suddenly beating teams we shouldn't be beating. It's been a bit of a crazy running, and I don't think, in a way, neither of us deserve it. But we find ourselves in a situation where Arsenal, at the time of recording, have to go and get results in James's Park, and because of our very niggly, difficult win against Burnley, which one was among the most unpleasant experiences watching a game that I've had in recent years. Nothing enjoyable about that 1-0 win against Burnley. And the final whistle was just greeted with relief and nothing else. So it was a strange way that to watch your team play. But we're in a situation now with that win that it's either, it's going to go to the end of the season, it's going to go to the last game, and we'll know where we're at, whether it's in our hands or in Arsenal hands, will depend on how well they do against Newcastle.
Yeah, so you're coming off the back of a 3-0 win against Arsenal and the mood is high. You can keep that push going on. But what was the mood like going into Burnley? You had 62 hours between the two games. Was there a sense that the Tottenham players were a little bit leggy and needed a bit more rest going into that game against Burnley?
Yeah, ideally we'd have been playing Monday night and not Arsenal. They had a significant advantage of that, especially because I think fans of all clubs will know that a Sunday lunchtime kickoff is not ideal. The fan base is hard to get up for. It's hard to get up for it as a fan base because you're half tired and probably a bit hungover from the night before. And as players, they're never great games, the early kickoffs. So, and we knew what Burnley were going to do. They were going to sit back. They were going to soak up. They're going to try and hit us with long balls and counter. To their credit, they played a much better brand of football than I'm used to seeing them under Sean Dyche. But it was still the same Burnley in terms of their physicality and what they do well. So we could have done with more time. We could have done with it being an evening kickoff, but we got it done. We got over the line. And if you achieve nothing in football, not that I know what success really sounds like or looks like anyway, but I know fundamentally from watching football that you'll achieve nothing if you don't win the games that you play poorly in. And we did win that game.
Yeah, you got over the line. And let's look a little bit more at the game itself. The first sort of 15 minutes, 86% possession of Tottenham, it felt like watching it, you were all over them and you had chance after chance that you couldn't convert. What was that like going into half time at that point?
It was frustrating because I was watching it with my old man and he said 25 minutes, he goes, now I'm starting to feel nervous. Now it feels like one of these days where the ball just will not go in for us. And we've seen it before. We've seen it this season. You know, against Brighton, they scored in the last minute and you kind of wish, waiting for it to happen. Certainly if you don't score early, you know you've got to win the game. It's without question you have to win it. So when the ball isn't going in and we're creating chances, and as you say, 82% possession, you'd think that one of those will be converted, especially because, you know, the talent we've got up top, you expect the ball to go in the net and it just wouldn't go in. So going into halftime, you're kind of aware that most goals are scored in the second half anyway, so you knew we were going to get chances. And sort of into the second half, Burnley was certainly the better team for the first 10 minutes. So you started to think, well, what is going on here? But as we scored that penalty, I know it's dubious, and you know it's been widely talked about whether or not that should have been a penalty or not.
What do you think?
I don't think it should be a penalty. I know the law exists and it was always going to be given, but I think they need to look at it again. There's nothing he can do about it. He's moving around the box. His arms are up in the air. The ball hits it. Then you've got to give it, unfortunately, because of the rules, but I don't think it, I don't think the game is better for that rule being in place, because you give away a really important decision, like giving a penalty away for something that's out of your control almost completely. And I sympathize with Burnley, because we've been in a similar situation, as you'll know, in the Champions League final, where Sissoko was given for a handball or something he couldn't control. And there's been other instances as well. Eric Dier did something very similar where his arm was out and it landed on it, and it was given. So it was always going to be given when the ref looked at it. I was under no doubt about it, but I do think the law needs to be looked at.
Yeah, well, the penalty was given and it did go your way, and there was no doubt then that Kane was going to score it, but he should have scored a lot more over the course of the game. But it's always difficult playing a team in the relegation zone, but Burnley's goalkeeper, Nick Pope, he was unreal on the day, wasn't he?
They were all their entire defensive unit was unreal. I mean, the amount of shots they blocked and the opportunities, they restricted us to sort of half chances, and no matter how close we got to the goal, they had three or four bodies in between us and Nick Pope. And then when we managed to get through them or around them, or just, you know, the luck fell to us, when we all we had to do is beat Nick Pope, he got his body in the way. And like I say, even being 1-0 up, you kind of feel like Burnley could break away and score here just because of their physicality. Ashley Barnes hit the post from about 20 yards out. That was actually as close as they got, pretty much. But it's 1-0 in that circumstance, with everything riding on it, and the outside narrative of the top race for Champions League and the top four, that 1-0 didn't feel very secure at all. Even if you look at it from a neutral's perspective, we were pretty comfortable. It's just so stressful when you're tied in it that you can't really see the positives that are in front of you. But yeah, Son had chances, Kane had chances, should have been more. But you know, we take the 1-0.
Yeah, you take the 1-0. And you mentioned their defensive unit there. Spurs have really struggled, especially earlier on in the season, to play against teams with their low block defence. Is that a sign of progress that you managed to come away with 3 points against a team like that that was going to set up in that way?
Yeah, I don't know if it's progress, because if we hadn't got that penalty, we might not have scored. I think we did enough to win the game, and we probably should have had a couple more, but it didn't go in and we did have to rely on that penalty. When Liverpool have to face up against teams that do this every single time, unless they're playing Manchester City and maybe a couple of others, maybe Chelsea. But even when they played Tottenham, you could see what we were doing, which was a low block, and then use the skill and pace that we have in our team to counterattack. What Spurs have that Burnley don't is Harry Kane, is Son, is Kulusevski, is Bentancur in midfield. So we are able to do that, sit back and break. When we face teams like Burnley, like Southampton did, Burnley away as well, is, you know, we struggle to break them down. And we don't have, I think every team does. I think Arsenal have struggled as well. And we don't have what Liverpool do have and what Man City do have, where you can really sweep these sides to the side if you score early or just keep prepping them. So I think there is a different mentality that under Conte that he's brought into the side in the last few months. He said himself 3 months ago we wouldn't have won that game, and he's probably right. Eric Dier said the same thing in his post-match interview as well, is that something's changing, and you expect it to with a manager like Conte at the helm. So, yeah, I mean, we needed to win. We did win, even though it was difficult.
Yeah, and you're not used to scrappy wins under Conte, are you? He's not a manager that wants to put you in that situation where you're edging to a win. But like you mentioned there, the mentality in the team seems to feel different now. Do you think that is because the chance for top four is still on and they know that the pressure's on them to keep on pushing and they'll get a win or whatever it takes now?
I think it's that winner's mentality is coming. How that translates to actual trophies in the future, I'm not sure. I don't know, because it's such a big gulf between where we are and where you guys are and Man City are and whatnot. Fundamentally, what you've got to do have is the right attitude for each game. And Conte talked a lot about controlling the game, controlling every aspect of the game, including your mindset. And that is changing. It takes a while for a manager to get his ideas and what he expects for players into a team. You start building and fixing some of the problems tactically, but then fundamentally you've got to work on the psychology. Klopp did a lot of that in his early part of his Liverpool career, not only with the players, but also creating a bond with the supporters, which is the envy of most anybody who watches football. So there's so much that needs to go into improving a team that is more than just the tactics, and the mentality is a part of that. And you saw how Conte reacted after the first loss to Burnley few months ago, where he's saying the board needs to decide whether or not I'm the right man to do this. Maybe I'm not the right man to do this with this squad. And at the time, we were panicking. You're like, maybe he does want out. Like, what, we've just got one of the world's best coaches and suddenly he wants out. And he said, and I don't know if there's a bit of revisionism on his part, but if you got to believe what he says to be true, if he's saying it is, he said that I said that to make the players know this is what they need to do in order for us, that this isn't acceptable. If you're not going to be able to amend or be malleable to my tactics and what I want from you, then I'm not the right man for the job. Everyone knows he is. Everyone knows his status is above Tottenham Hotspurs as it stands. So, yeah, it's about the players buying into it, and they finally have. I'm not sure if I've answered your question there.
No, you have. Yeah, definitely. So what does a good season look like now for Tottenham? Would it be a sense of dissatisfaction finishing in those Europa League places? It still is a little bit out of your hands, depending on the Arsenal result tonight. But
yeah,
would there be a sense that that's a real letdown and a bit of a failure? Or will you be happy with that and playing European football at that level again?
Right now, obviously, it would be horrendous because for twofold, we got so close. It has been in our hands, just a few games ago. And the fact that we're giving it up to our main rivals, Arsenal, makes it difficult, right, to deal with. It's sort of sweetened by the fact that we just slapped them last Thursday. So even if they finish above us, we've still got something to crow about in terms of that. I think in the immediacy, if we don't get there, it will feel pretty sore. But if you're looking at philosophically, you're looking at what the club was doing before Conte took over. The fact that we've had two managers this year, that we started with Nuno Espirito Santo, went through one of the worst Septembers I've ever seen at Tottenham, or probably the worst, got slapped in four games, lost five on the bounce, all by three goals or more. To this, where we're on the precipice of European football, Champions League football no less, you've got to look at that as massive progress. You're looking at what Daniel Levy's done in terms of being Paratici and Conte, Paratici being the director of football who has many fingers and many pies. The business we did in January with Romero in the summer, but when Paratici came in, he brought Romero, Kulusevski and Bentancur, who turned us around. It looks rosy for the future. And I think regardless of whether Arsenal finish in the top four or not, we're finishing above them next season. And I think Champions League football is coming next season to Tottenham through qualification of the league if we don't get it this year, just on the fact that we have Conte and it seems Daniel Levy is ready to spend on the first team. And, I'm really confident. I feel relaxed about Spurs for the first time in about 4 years, where Pochettino was our manager and everything felt rosy. Having Jose Mourinho as your manager isn't fun. Nuno Espirito Santo felt like it was just a matter of time before he gets sacked, even a few games in. And now we have Conte, where you think, we know how long he's going to be with us for, but even if it's for the end of his contract, which despite being everyone saying it's 18 months, actually 2.5 years, there's an extension clause in there. And if he's happy, then he'll do that. So I feel relaxed. I feel good about it and optimistic about the future. It could all go tits up very, very quickly, but right now I feel good.
Right now you're feeling good. Give me a final prediction for the last day of the season. What do you think is going to happen?
My feeling right now is that Arsenal will draw at Newcastle. Ooh. And I feel like we'll have to beat Norwich away. And I think we'll do it. I think we're going to get over the line. I really do. But there's nothing between us for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
I feel like we will beat them. Just as a caveat, that is that we were in a similar situation about 6-7 years ago, where we had to beat a relegated Newcastle side to get into the top four, and Arsenal had to, well, we just had to better their result basically, and we lost 5-1 on the final day of the season at St James's Park to a relegated Newcastle team, and that we needed that for Champions League football. So I've been here before, not that twice I've been here before, but this is different Tottenham, different manager, and we'll see. But I think we're going to get over the line.
Different Tottenham, different manager. I'm sure you'll all be watching Arsenal with a keen eye tonight. But good luck for the rest of the season, Flav, and thanks for joining us.
And to finish up then with Leeds United and Phil Hay, who writes for The Athletic on Leeds. And Phil, I mean, I spent most of yesterday consuming everything I possibly could about our FA Cup final win. There's not a video online that I've not watched. But I did find some time, obviously, to enjoy the Premier League action and to read your beautiful piece, I will describe it as, Phil, not to embarrass you too much. you know, this is Leeds and Leeds do not go quietly. And it was a fantastic piece of writing for, you know, to be done in an emotive time that really took me there, which is what the best writing does, I feel, to Leeds. Because in, you know, if you looked at the scoreline in isolation, you'd have thought, oh, that must be a little bit of a disappointing one. They'd have wanted to win this home game, a very winnable home game in the context of the Premier League and life, but they didn't. But the way that your writing describes it is a huge boost, a big moment, and maybe the point that keeps Leeds United up.
The margins are so fine at the bottom, to the extent where for the last couple of weeks we've really started to wonder if Leeds United's appalling goal difference will come into play. They're so fine that it is now at the stage where individual points are going to make a really big difference. And I think the last fortnight in Leeds, it's been downbeat, it's been fairly despondent. There was a massive change in the wind around the weekend where Leeds lost to Manchester City, Burnley won down at Watford, and Everton beat Chelsea. I think for the first time, leaving Leeds with that feeling that Burnley and Everton had already had, which is that maybe it's them, you know, maybe yeah. It is them who are going to go. And one of the things that everybody's been focusing on is the run that Burnley have got, the fixtures they've got, and the thought that Burnley might not get another point from those. And because of that, it was hard not to feel yesterday that actually that point could be absolutely critical. And given the state of the game, I mean, I seem to remember, I might be wrong, but I seem to remember us talking after the Norwich game where Gelhardt scored very, very late on. Yeah. And it wasn't an identical match by any stretch, but it was an identical scenario at that point in it, you know, where they needed a win against Norwich. They needed anything against Brighton yesterday. And the funny thing about that piece that was written today is the way that it changes in that instant from a piece that would have been about a complete meltdown, you know, descent towards the board, kind of point of chance about Bielsa when Marsh made two substitutions late in the second half, which are very much for his benefit and also for the directors as well. The kind of loss of patience, which has been in the post for a little while, but it's taken so long to come at Elland Road. That would have been the entire theme of it. But there you have at the end, 92nd minute, one goal which completely changes the atmosphere and completely changes the tone. And it's not as if it wipes away all the problems or, you know, cuts short all the questions that are going to need to be asked. But, you know, on that day at least, it did stop what looked like inevitable mutiny.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it could have been sort of very different. And you know, it's all about momentum shifts, isn't it? Football is football on the pitches, but wider than that as well. And, you know, other clubs who were feeling, you know, positive are suddenly less so. And it's quite a swing to say Everton, for example, who, you know, you saw the pictures before the game that they're welcoming the coach, you know, they've seen the power that they've had in recent home games, you know, beating Manchester United and Chelsea, and they're buoyed. And suddenly, you know, they're getting beat sort of 3-2, and you know they're going from a team who looked like they were going to be okay to right drag back in it. And moods around football teams, football grounds, and football training grounds are a funny thing. And you're much closer, you know, to football clubs than me. But it is a funny thing, really. And you know, that goal might just be a thing, and obviously what happens at Goodison Park as well might be just be a thing that suddenly changes everyone's attitude going into training today.
Yeah, I think it comes down in no small part to the assumptions that people make. I mean, I found it really interesting on Wednesday. Leeds played Chelsea on Wednesday, lost heavily, had a man sent off. Sorry, John, excuse me.
No worries.
In the programme notes beforehand, the chief executive said, we're in a two-horse race, i.e. Leeds and Burnley for the last spot. Now, I kind of understood that because Everton were away at Watford, a game they ought to have won beforehand, although it sounded like a dreadful game in the flesh from what I could gather. And because of the games in hand, because they had two at home coming up, Brentford and then followed by Crystal Palace, you did feel as if Everton, without being out of it, were actually out of it, you know, as if they were going to spring far enough ahead. And it struck me as quite fascinating that the chief exec of Leeds was willing to say as much, you know, was willing to say, look, as far as he's concerned, it's us or Burnley, that's how mm-hmm. it's going to be. Whereas in actual fact, Everton are still in good shape and Everton will be safe if they win their game in hand. But they're still in it. And we've gone through, as always seems to happen at this stage of the season, we've gone through weekend after weekend where it has ebbed and flowed. And there's been a spell where it's gone particularly well for Burnley, which has got them back into it. But then they've got two games to go and a week of the season left. And despite that, despite the upturn in form and despite Mike Jackson winning manager of the month, they're still in 18th. And as it stands, they'll go down if they don't get another point. And, you know, psychologically, I think that can have quite a big effect on clubs. I think it will potentially have quite a big effect on Leeds, and certainly did after the game yesterday, that having had such a bad couple of weeks and having had all the dissent yesterday and, you know, the kind of the build-up of poison in the stands. And I've got to say, I've said this all season, the crowd have been so supportive at Elland Road. It's impossible to point the finger of blame at them. But everybody again came away from Elland Road with optimism, which just didn't feel like it was going to be there. And it could be the turning point for them.
No, absolutely. You mentioned in the Chelsea game and the red card, there's been quite a lot of times where Leeds have had to play with 10 men recently. What do you put that down to? Is it bad luck? Is it bad tackles? Is it bad individual moments? Or is there something around the pressure of relegation that's just making seemingly sensible footballers do rash things?
Definitely two bad challenges. I mean, they were clear red cards, the Ailing one and the Dan James one. They were also pretty unnecessary tackles in the area of the pitch where they were committed. Jesse Marsh, the head coach who came in after Bielsa, he is quite tub-thumping in the way that he speaks. He has talked about wanting players to be more aggressive, for aggression to be part of the football. But I think it's probably a little bit simplistic to draw a line between that and the fact that they've had red cards in the game against Arsenal and Chelsea. I think it's far more likely to be down to partly pressure, like you said, but also I think frustration at the way it's going. I mean, Ailing is an ex-Arsenal player, which, again, you know, a bit of a correlation there, but I don't know if that would necessarily be a factor. But I think 2-0 down away to Arsenal, you know, a game that they needed to take something from them, which had gone within the space of 10 minutes, I think it is just pressure. It is frustration. It's pure annoyance with the way everything's going. It's the fear at the back of your head as well that relegation's coming, because it's not, I think particularly for some of these players, it's not that anybody especially wants to have relegation beside their name in any given season, but a lot of these players were core parts of or core members of the Bielsa squad, the Bielsa team, huge players through that period. And it felt like such a defining moment for Leeds when they were promoted, in the way that it felt like such a defining era having Bielsa here. And I think to bookend that with relegation and for the club to finish up where they started when Bielsa came in would be extremely hard to take. I imagine that is in no small part what's in Ailing's head. But it has just been rushes of blood, you know, yeah. Rushes of blood to the head when you don't need them. And it has been extremely costly. But it has to be said that if there were games in this run that Leeds were likely to rely on more than others, Brighton and Brentford were the ones. You know, I don't think many of us fancy them to take anything from City, Arsenal or Chelsea.
The danger, I guess, with Brentford is that they seemingly are keeping going. I just spoke to a Southampton fan for another show ahead of our game against them on Tuesday, and she was saying, oh, we're so on the beach, it's untrue. And she was, whereas Brentford, I guess, because the first year in it and they're enjoying themselves and things like that, and we've been last home game. You know, they say a team with nothing to play for is what you want, but Brentford don't seem to be following that at the moment, which must be a slight concern and annoyance.
I have to say that I have noticed an issue, really, which is that teams who have been able to play against Leeds fairly freely and without much on them, Aston Villa and Marsh's home game, I thought Brighton again yesterday, that there have been others, have benefited from the fact that they've been able to play freely. And it's been quite obvious, I think, that the sides who don't feel like there's much at stake can almost enjoy it and can almost let it flow. Whereas with Leeds, you can see that they're tight, you can see that they're tense, you can see that they're still stuck between stuck in this transition between Bielsa's system, which was so defined and which everybody understood, to Marsh's ideal system, which just hasn't taken hold and at the moment is quite hard to be sure of what it's supposed to be. I got the sense from listening to Graham Potter after the game yesterday that he was very keen that Brighton won't seem to be throwing that game yesterday, which they absolutely didn't. I mean, they deserved to win it, I felt. And would have won it if Welbeck hadn't missed a sitter of a header with a few minutes to go. But the last day of the season always tends to be a little bit different. You do tend to find when it comes to, you know, game 38, last day, last weekend, that there are certain teams who do feel like they're just going through the motions a little and ticking, you know, ticking the minutes off, and then everybody can head off on holiday. And I think that's unavoidable, and it's pretty much inevitable. I think without straying off the topic of conversation, I think the reason why Man City would have been so worried yesterday, 2-0 down at West Ham, is because Southampton Liverpool has the potential to be a very high scoring win for Liverpool, and it could, you know, that could have changed absolutely everything. Leeds, when it comes to Leeds' goal difference, it's so dreadfully bad that they're not going to redress that in the game that's left. It's not going to turn around. So essentially, they have to make sure that they keep Burnley behind them. That is going to be, as I say, I think Everton will get out of this. I think it will be one from Burnley or Leeds. But at the moment, Leeds have, by a really fine margin, the upper hand.
Yeah, we shall see. We shall see what happens next. Huge thanks to Phil for joining us. As I say, I do encourage everyone to read this piece that came out sort of overnight. This is Leeds, and Leeds do not cope quietly. I don't think Leeds do much quietly, to be honest with you. But I don't think they're supposed to ever anyway. Thanks a lot to Phil and, of course, all our callers today. Hope you've enjoyed that coaching.